Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter, ensuring you won't miss a show release. You can also access more information on the topics covered, related recommendations, partnerships and collaborations that might appeal. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. I should like to quote the New York Times that wrote of you, "If the American economy cranked out goods as prolifically as Neil Ferguson does history, we might not be in half the fix we are now." He's like the brightest kid in the debating club, the one who pulls all-nighters in the library and ferrets out facts no one thought to uncover. So, Neil, I want to open with saying how thrilled both Will Campion, who you've known for many years and is the co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, and I are to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making the time today.
My pleasure, Simon, and it's also nice to be able to connect virtually with Will, who used to be a near neighbor many years ago, but I've since crossed the Atlantic, and so we see one another much less frequently.
I've been very excited about this conversation. I realized in preparation there were so many topics that the listeners would love to hear your views on, but we're going to try and concentrate on five big topics: this pandemic and your analysis in your upcoming book, The Politics of Catastrophe, the debasement of money, why you and Henry Kissinger think China is the new enemy, radical Islam and the de-Christianization of Europe, and the future of education. My job is to try and marshal our conversation and maybe draw some conclusions on investing in this highly fractured world. Before we start, I think we should pay tribute to one of the acting greats and a fellow Scot who just died, Sean Connery. Now, am I right in saying that you knew him?
I did know Sean Connery, one of my heroes when I was growing up in Scotland. We all kind of fantasized about being 007 when the part was being played by Sean. And he and I met quite a few years ago now in the Bahamas under rather odd circumstances. I was speaking at Lyford Key at a conference organized by one of the investment banks. And after the conference, and I was about to head to the airport, one of the organizers said, "Before you go, Neil, there's someone I think you'd really love to meet." And I said, "Who?" And he said, "You'll see. It's a surprise, but you won't regret it. Come with me." So I went with this chap up to a door of a relatively small cottage by the edge of the golf course. He knocked on the door. I had no idea who was going to open the door. And it was Sean Connery, who was a formidable figure who stood at least 6'3" and whose shoulders were very broad and filled the doorway. He was obviously in the middle of his lunch and was wearing a sarong. And he didn't look terribly pleased to be disturbed. So he raised the eyebrow, the famous eyebrow, and said, "Yes." And I couldn't think of what to say. I was completely flabbergasted and covered in embarrassment and wanted the ground to swallow me up. But eventually I blurted out, "It's a great honor to meet you, Mr. Connery. I think I learned everything about how to be a man from watching you in the Air Odeon cinema." Connery looked at me and replied, "Oh, that's strange. Don't you know I'm a homosexual?" To which I desperately responded, "Is that why you're wearing a skirt?" And we kind of got on famously after that. We saw one another quite often whenever I was down that way. Got to know his lovely wife, Micheline, and his son, Jason, and hadn't seen him for a few years, had heard he'd been frail and not so often golfing. And so I was kind of bracing myself for the news that he died. What a terrific actor, an imposing personality, as intimidating an individual as I think I've ever run across. A tremendous flirt with my wife too, in a lovely way.
Right. Well, I actually served him breakfast when I was a student and a waiter in the Grosvenor House Hotel, and I think I even felt intimidated rolling the trolley into his room. So let's turn to you, Neil. You are one of the world's most renowned, revered, respected, and recognized historians. Brilliant, breathtaking, and bold. And those are just my descriptions of your work. So to recap, you are or have been a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, a senior faculty fellow at Harvard, a visiting professor at Tsinghua University, Beijing. You are a professor in financial history at the New York University Stern School, a senior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford. You held the Philip Roman Chair in History and International Affairs at the LSE, the author of 15 books. You won an International Emmy for the film The Ascent of Money, a regular columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and the founder and managing director of Greenmantle LLC, an advisory firm. Wow, that's like five great people's CVs rolled into one.
The affiliation, the primary day job is at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I'm still involved at the Belfer Center at Harvard, and those are my kind of headquarters. And then there's Greenmantle, which is my kind of for-profit wing. So yeah, I'm kept busy.
So let's talk about your early years. I think your father was a doctor and your mother was a physics teacher, and you'd read War and Peace at the age of 15. But how do you remember your childhood and how did it shape you?
Well, my mother's still alive, I'm glad to say, though my father died a few years ago. They were, of course, the principal influences on my life. And I owe them an enormous unpayable debt because they brought me up with a love of knowledge, a belief in the transformative power of education, a profound respect for the natural sciences. The rest of my family are scientists, including my sister, who's a physicist at Yale, but also a love of literature and constant encouragement to pursue the passions that I developed over my childhood, which ranged from football to punk rock to, by the time I was in my late teens, the politics of Margaret Thatcher, which really wasn't their cup of tea. And they never stopped encouraging me to do whatever I did wholeheartedly to the best of my ability. That was a wonderful gift. My father never steered me in the direction of medicine as some of my friends' fathers did. So I was just given tremendous opportunities. The house was full of books. My grandfather on my mother's side was a big influence. He was a journalist, had had his career as chief sub-editor in the Glasgow Herald disrupted by World War II. So he was a big influence on me and encouraged me to think of writing as a vocation. And because I found writing easy, it came very naturally. From quite an early age, I imagined myself a writer. And that was something that my grandfather was very good at encouraging. He'd let me play with his typewriter when I was quite young. My other grandfather on my father's side was an older man who died when I was relatively young, but he had served in the First World War in one of the Highland regiments. And I think I grew up with a keen sense on both sides of the family of the power of history, that we weren't just products of our immediate circumstances, but we were all, as a family, products of history. And that history was very visible around me. My grandmother's house in Shettleston, a council house in the east end of Glasgow. There were all these things that my grandfather had accumulated in his life, including things he'd picked up when he was selling scotch to the natives in Ecuador. He'd been paid at one point, not in cash, but in paintings. So there were these wonderful paintings by indigenous artists. There were these wonderful photograph albums that my mother's father had put together from his time in the Royal Air Force in India and Burma. All of that kindled my imagination as a boy. And I think it meant when I was trying to decide what kind of writer to be, history won out over literature, over fiction. I remember having this epiphany, which was partly prompted by reading War and Peace, as you mentioned, that I wasn't going to be a novelist. I was going to be a historian because I found reality ultimately more engaging and often more fantastical than anything I could imagine.
Well, let's talk about your new book, The Politics of Catastrophe. Disasters are, of course, usually unpredictable, but you've made the point that when disaster strikes, we ought to be better prepared than the Romans were when Vesuvius erupted. But I guess, why do you think the responses of a number of developed countries to this crisis appear to have been so badly bungled?
Well, first, Simon, the book is called Doom, and The Politics of Catastrophe is the subtitle. I've always kind of wanted to call a book Doom, and 2020 gave me the opportunity. It's not a book, I hasten to add, just about COVID-19. There will be plenty of those. This is a general history of disaster, of all kinds of disaster, not just pandemics, but you name it. Wars, financial crises, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, tsunamis, ships that sink, the Titanic, spaceships that blow up, the Challenger. I tried to make sure that all the disasters were there and to then put together what might be called the general theory of disaster. And I think that's really the book's contribution, that at the end of it, you sense that although each disaster is distinct, they have common properties, common characteristics. In the case of the pandemic that we've experienced this year and will continue, I think, to be dealing with next year, the striking feature to me of much media coverage was the tendency to blame or at least attach enormous importance to the actions of a few leaders. Therefore, in the United States, Donald Trump was somehow to blame for the mishandling of the pandemic. And in the UK, it was Boris Johnson or Dom Cummings. But actually, what I've learned from writing Doom is that points of failure generally are further down the chain of command than at the very top. It wasn't, for example, Donald Trump's job to make sure that there was adequate testing for a new coronavirus in the early part of 2020. That was the job of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and they completely blew it. It wasn't for Boris Johnson to decide what the correct strategy was in the face of a novel pathogen. That was up to the scientific advisors that the government has, and they also got it very wrong. And we know that it didn't need to be got wrong because there were countries that got it right, like Taiwan and South Korea. In Taiwan, the number of deaths from COVID-19 is in single digits, despite the fact that they're right next door to the People's Republic of China, where the virus originated. So I try to show in the book that while you can't say Boris Johnson or Donald Trump did a great job, that would be absurd. Trump in particular did a pretty bad job. It wasn't really down to their decisions at the top. What went wrong was a colossal failure of our public health bureaucracy. And it happened in many countries in the Western world, including some that did not have populist leaders. Think of Belgium, for example, or for that matter, Italy. So I think you have to recognize that there was a generalized failure of public health systems to recognize the nature of the new virus and the disease it caused, and to act quickly enough in the right ways to deal with it. There were right ways to deal with it. You had to ramp up testing furiously. You then had to use contact tracing to identify the super spreaders. And then you needed to effectively quarantine or isolate people who were carrying or might be carrying the disease. That was done in Taiwan and South Korea. And we utterly failed to get those things right and ended up having to do lockdowns, which are an incredibly crude way of dealing with a pandemic like this. And we're still failing, by the way, here in November when we're talking, we're still failing to get that right. It's absolutely shocking to me that in the United States and in Europe, there has been still a failure to learn the lessons of the successful countries in East Asia. That, again, I don't think you can blame entirely on a handful of leaders. This is a generalized failure that we will have to think very long and hard about if we're to avoid similar failures happening when another kind of disaster comes along, because another kind of disaster will be next up. You rarely get the same disaster twice in a row. And we'll be terribly busy learning the lessons of COVID-19, preparing for the next pandemic. And then something else will come along quite different and catch us equally by surprise.
So at the same time that we've had these very mixed responses from various quarters of the world, we've had the notable Western response, which is essentially money creation. Now, you're the author of The Ascent of Money, which is a fantastic journey through the world of financial evolution. And anybody who hasn't read it, who's listening, really absolutely should. But history is littered with mismanagement of the currencies from Henry VIII to the Weimar Republic. And I wondered, as we see the really these central banks, and I think it started with long-term capital management's failure in 98, but every issue along the lines of the great financial crisis and COVID has been responded to with increasing monetary accommodation. And I wondered what you think of both the historic parallels, but also the consequences of printing to alleviate short-term pain.
Well, I started my career as a research historian working on the Weimar hyperinflation of 1923. And really those years as a graduate student that I spent in Germany were devoted partly to learning economics as an historian. I'm not an economist, but I'm an economic historian, and I think of economic problems through history rather than through formal mathematical models. Sometimes I think that's actually an advantage. I think when you look at the most recent history of the Western world, and particularly, I should say, the developed world, because it's a different story for emerging markets, there has been much less inflationary risk to monetary policy than most people feared. I'm thinking here of the debates that happened after 2008, 2009, when the Federal Reserve embarked on quantitative easing. And there were those people, and I was one of them, who worried that a QE might have some adverse inflationary or financial stability effects. I think the financial stability concern was legitimate because we ended up with asset price inflation as a feature of the recovery from 2008-9. But the fear that there would be inflation in the conventional sense of consumer price inflation was wrong. And it was Larry Summers, my old boss at Harvard, who was right to say that we were in the terrain of secular stagnation. The same applies, I think, to the response to the pandemic. In March, many policymakers in the US and to an extent in Europe essentially looked at COVID-19 as if it were a financial crisis. If everything looks like a financial crisis, you tend to use the same tools. So there was this tremendous effort to offset the shock with both monetary and fiscal expansion, which has in some ways mitigated the adverse effects of the lockdowns. It was mainly the lockdowns, but also the behavioral adaptation of people that caused this great economic contraction to happen in the spring. And that created significant financial risk in mid-March. I don't think anybody would seriously argue that it was the wrong thing under those circumstances to try to shore up demand with public spending of all kinds, effectively forms of universal basic income, and that central banks should accommodate that with another round of quantitative easing, in effect buying the new bonds that governments were issuing.
Yet this is the first pandemic since 1971. The year Nixon severed convertibility of gold into the US dollar. And from that point, there's been no limit to the amount of money that can be created.
The reason that's not inflationary, and this is something that I worked on early 2010s, you're not printing money, actually. The way you're doing it is creating excess bank reserves, which are a special kind of money on which interest is paid. And so it's not actually that you're printing dollars in the sense that the Germans printed marks in the early 1920s. What you're doing is essentially creating a special kind of money. And the inflation risk is only going to arise if banks start making credit very readily available and consumers start taking advantage of that and, crucially, expecting and anticipating inflation. If we start to think there is an inflation risk, then I think behavior might change quite swiftly. But that's not really in prospect at the moment. For the foreseeable future, the world's relatively deflationary because of the shock of the pandemic. And that will continue to be true into next year. In fact, in Europe and in the UK too, the deflation risk is clearly quite serious. In the US, less so because the US economy is bouncing back faster than the European economies. Is there an inflation risk at some point in the future? Yes. I don't think secular stagnation can last forever. And the lesson of history is that even in periods of low to negative inflation, things can change. Events can change. Inflation expectations can suddenly be altered. For example, historically, it's very often war that causes that to happen. And wars have been the starting point of most of the world's big inflations. So if there were a big war, let's suppose the US and China went to war over the South China Sea or over Taiwan or over something else, then I think you'd suddenly find yourself reminded of why inflation happens. But I think in the absence of that kind of geopolitical shock, there isn't really an inflationary risk at the moment. The bigger risk is that we actually allow economic activity to slump. And we could find ourselves in Europe in a double dip recession very soon indeed, precisely because that's happening.
Right. I guess from an investor standpoint, thinking about protection from debasement, I've had lots of discussions on the show about gold. I'm a big fan of owning gold and have been for a long time. So one thinks about gold and real assets. But we've also got this discussion around Bitcoin, which I guess I'm intrigued. Are there any parallels for a new medium of exchange to have arrived and persisted, such as perhaps some would believe is the case with Bitcoin?
Well, I've written a bit about this. I updated the Ascent of Money 2 years ago to mark its 10th anniversary and added a section on cryptocurrency. It may not be correct to think of Bitcoin as a means of payment entirely, because it's behaving much more like a kind of store of value, a digital asset, which has peculiar properties. And those peculiar properties make Bitcoin quite attractive as an asset. One of my good friends in New York, Matt McLennan, came up with a nice formulation for Bitcoin when he said it was an option on digital gold. And it behaves somewhat like that. And I think that what will happen, it's already happening actually, is that more and more people will want to have some Bitcoin in their portfolios, just as you have some gold in yours. And indeed, it would make sense to have a bit of both, not a huge proportion of your assets, but you would definitely want to have maybe 1% or 2%, because Bitcoin looks to be here to stay. Those like Nouriel Roubini, who called it shitcoin and predicted it would go to zero when the last bubble burst, I think looked kind of silly, because it seems pretty clear they didn't really know what they were talking about. And actually, a lot of standard economists haven't understood cryptocurrency at all well. Paul Krugman was completely dismissive when he wrote about it. Paul Krugman was dismissive of the internet when he wrote about it back in the 1990s. Economists haven't been very clever about this. Economists kind of like the existing system, the system of macroeconomics, which excludes money and finance largely from the models. To an historian, it's just another case of financial innovation and experimentation. When the original Bitcoin paper was published in 2008, it was essentially saying you can use blockchain to create forms of transaction that won't require third-party authentication, because the blockchain will be the authentication. And this was a brilliant insight. I think it's going to be the basis for a great many things besides Bitcoin, including all sorts of forms of document storage. But Bitcoin is not a very efficient way of paying for things. I mean, you wouldn't want to go into Starbucks and pay with Bitcoin, not least because of the volatility of Bitcoin's price in dollar terms. So I don't think in the future Bitcoin replaces the dollar as, or the pound for that matter, as the way you pay for stuff. Rather, I think it becomes a form of asset that you want to hold because it doesn't correlate closely or not that closely with other asset classes. There's a whole other story to be told about the Ethereum-based tokens or cryptocurrencies. I think there's lots and lots of innovation going on there and in decentralized finance with things that are a good deal newer and experimental. But I think Bitcoin is here to stay, not as money, but more as a kind of option on digital gold. I don't know, actually, that Bitcoin or gold will prove to be valuable as inflation hedges. I mean, to me, the funny thing is that people started to talk about cryptocurrency as if it was a solution to the problem of inflation at a time when the problem of inflation had gone away. I mean, to worry about inflation in this era of financial history is to worry about the wrong thing. You're fighting the last war. This is not the 1970s. The real value of gold and Bitcoin doesn't lie in there being inflation hedges, unless you're in Argentina or in Venezuela or in some other country where the currency is actually subject to depreciation. I think if you're in the UK or the US, this is just a new kind of asset, which will very probably have some significant upside over a two-year holding period. So I've been long Bitcoin since the 2017 rally. I was a bit late to the party. My teenage son, Lachlan, was, well, he's not a teenager anymore, but he was a teenager when we first talked about this, was much quicker to see that Bitcoin would be a good investment. If I'd listened to him, I'd probably have retired by now on the proceeds of my Bitcoin positions. But I still think long Bitcoin is the smart play. It's volatile. It'll have its drawdowns. But I think if you don't own Bitcoin, you'll wish you had 5 years from now.
So the other side of this monetary equation is this terrific rise in the level of debt. I mean, governments have actually stopped talking about the dangers of debt rather extraordinarily, at least for me. And much is made of the fact that debt levels were higher at the end of the Napoleonic Wars in the UK and in the UK and the US at the end of World War II. But how do you think about those levels of debt and the implications going forward?
Well, I think that the least surprising thing about 2020 is that there have been big jumps upward in government debt, because ultimately we decided to treat this a bit like a war. That was not necessarily what we had to do, but because we failed to do the Taiwanese or South Korean response and ended up doing lockdowns and cratering economic growth for some period of time, we then had to kind of offset that shock somehow. And the only real option was to use essentially Keynesian methods, not a stimulus, that's the wrong terminology, but there's relief. I mean, you had to relieve people who were unable to work because you'd effectively placed them under house arrest. So we've kind of gone to war against COVID-19. I must say the war is not going as well as it might have, and it ain't over. As long as we're fighting this war, we're going to be accumulating debt, just as in a regular war. It doesn't really matter whether you're fighting germs or Germans. If you're fighting them in ways that are highly economically disruptive, you're going to increase public debt. There must be some upper bound to what is sustainable in terms of a country's public debt, but it isn't the same for every country. It's much lower if you're Argentina and have a terrible track record of default and depreciation. It's a great deal higher if you're the United States and you print the world's reserve currency. The US has had a debt to GDP ratio above 100% in the past at the end of World War II. The UK has had a debt to GDP ratio above 200% after the Napoleonic Wars and after the world wars of the 20th century. So we're not into the realm of the unprecedented yet. The problems are the same, though, as they were after the world wars and indeed after the Napoleonic Wars. At some point, you have to decide how to A, stop borrowing, because you can't borrow forever, and B, manage the debt service on the debt. If that costs more in real terms than your economic growth rate, you're in trouble. So I think there are some debt management problems that are as old as the hills lying ahead for us in the coming years. Temporarily, central banks can keep the real rate on the debt at zero or even cap it negative through what's called yield curve control. So monetary policy originated as a debt management system. That's what central banks were originally for. And central banks are now reverting to debt management as their primary function rather than price stability. And so we're going to manage the debt by making sure that the real rates don't spike. That's really what central bankers are going to spend the next 5 or so years doing. And some countries will fail to achieve that. It'll be really tricky for Italy, for example, given that Italy doesn't control its own monetary policy, but has a huge pile of debt. At some point, that's going to be a problem, even if it's not a problem right now. The UK is in a different position because, thank God, the UK did not join the European Monetary Union, which would have been a catastrophic mistake. And so the UK has relative room for maneuver, but less than the US because the sterling is no longer a top flight reserve currency. So I think the UK is going to have to be a little careful not to get into an unsustainable debt position. Unlike Italy, the UK's problem would be that sterling would end up taking some serious punishment if the UK really got into a dangerous position. That's the UK's vulnerability. So I think the way to think about this is not that we're all heading for hyperinflation, which is the sort of standard zero hedge type way of writing about this. That's not the problem. The problem is that we're all heading for problems of debt management. And for some countries, those problems will be much, much tougher than for others. I'd rather be the US in this situation than anybody else, simply because there is such a massive global appetite for US treasuries. The US has basically limitless borrowing capability. It's not making much use of it right now because it's essentially buying the new bonds through the Fed. I mean, the Fed has bought nearly all the new debt issued this year. But I think ultimately the US has much more room for maneuver than anybody else. And I think the US can sustain a debt to GDP ratio of 200% relatively comfortably. Although the lesson from British history is after a certain point, that constrains you. Britain's problem in the 20th century was that the debt burden after 1918 was such that it was really hard to maintain British imperial defense at the levels that would have been necessary to deter Germany. The American problem will be that the defense budget will get squeezed because the interest payments will eat such a large chunk of the federal budget. That's going to be the weakness that ultimately gets exposed by the Chinese challenge.
So that's a great juncture for us to talk about this worsening China-American relationship. But because we have so much to discuss, and this is a compelling conversation that extends for some time, we're splitting this podcast into two parts. So as they say, that's all for now, folks. Until next week, when we discuss China and the new Cold War, radical Islamification, where education is failing, and the transformative power of new technologies. See you then. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.